Dr. Jessica Zitter is one of only a handful of physicians in the United States double board certified to practice both pulmonary critical care medicine and palliative care medicine. She's the doctor who will save you when you're admitted to the ICU, but she's also the doctor who can help you navigate a peaceful and easy way to end when the end really arrives. Her new book is Extreme Measures. We learn about a framework for a better way to exit life that will change our medical culture at the deepest level and will perhaps leave you pondering when the end is near. In our zeal to save life, are we often just worsening death? Dr. Jessica Zitter is an expert on the medical experience of death and dying. Again, the name of the new book is Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. And we welcome Dr. Zitter to the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. Very nice to have you with us.
So glad to be here. Thank you.
I can't tell you how much I enjoyed reading this book, because I found it to be so interesting and really gave me some new thoughts and thinking about things that I had never fully explored before. What got you on this path and thinking about it, especially as a physician?
Well, I went into medicine with this model of intervention and aggressive treatment being the manifestation of caring for your patients. I came from a family of surgeons, very sort of aggressive, reflexive, and I thought that's what it meant to be a doctor. And so I went into the intensive care unit, to pulmonary and critical care medicine, to do that, to save lives, to rescue people, to not have to ask too many questions, just to be reflexive. And I realized within a very short period of time that somehow we were missing the mark on many patients. Obviously, for some patients, we really were successful. And, you know, people, we really saved lives. And that was the thrill that I had been looking for. But there was just such a huge population of people who arrived in my ICU who were not people whose lives were likely to be reactivated from our treatments and technologies, more likely that they were actually going to be having a prolonged death on our machines. And those are the seriously ill, the frail, the elderly. And that's when I started feeling like I wasn't necessarily sure that this paradigm was working all the time.
How do we get to that paradigm, do you think?
Well, I think it's a really interesting kind of perfect storm. I think what happens is we all have almost a genetically implanted desire to live forever. This sort of drive, the human drive to stay alive, this fantasy of perpetual life is as old as the hills. I mean, there are Greek myths about it. And what's happened over the past many decades, really since the 30s and 40s, is that we've actually developed these treatments that, you know, and technologies and machines like the iron lung, for example, during this polio epidemic of the 30s and 40s and 50s, that actually saved lives. They were this miracle cure. They actually took people who were on the verge of death and young people, and they sent them back to live a full and complete life. And I think it sort of answered this human desire for this fountain of youth, this magic pill, this miracle cure. And then we went on from there to just develop more and more technologies and to specialize our physicians more and more narrowly to do these technologies. And we kind of lost sight of the patient.
That idea of losing sight of the patient, is that still... And I don't mean this in any way other than, I mean, is that still a struggle for you and for other physicians just because there's so much other stuff going on?
Yeah, it is a struggle. It is. And you know, I've been practicing for 10 years as a palliative care physician. I write extensively about the importance of patient-centered care. If anyone's going to not have a struggle to do this, it should be me. And yet I can tell you that I still have a struggle. And why? For so many reasons. Because this culture is steeped in the belief that more is better, more technology is better. You know, death is failure. Admitting that death is approaching is robbing people of hope. I mean, there's all these beliefs about it that are part of the way I was raised and trained as well. And so I'm always finding myself having to struggle against that and having to struggle against just rushing off to do that next catheter and to sit down and actually talk to my patients. It's a lot of work. And the infrastructure doesn't support it either. I mean, we don't have time in our day. You know, currently we only have given this responsibility of telling truth and just talking about decision making to the doctor and the patient. We don't have other people who are identified as being part of this decision making team, this communication team, and so we're relying on this one doctor who's harried and who's been trained as I just described, and it's just not working very well. There's not a lot of infrastructural support for us to do this.
You were featured in a documentary called Extremis, which is it's on Netflix, and it was nominated for an Academy Award as Best Documentary Short. And you all didn't win. Did you go to the awards, by the way?
I did. It was quite an experience.
I bet it was. And you were there to the very end.
Oh, yes, I certainly was.
You probably, quite interesting. Yeah, if you kept on going, you could have, you know, maybe you won. You don't know. but the film really stayed with me. It was something that I viewed actually a couple of times, because there is you show such a compassion, but also it's a really interesting look into how the families of the patients feel about that, and it gets into the psychological and the relationship that they often have with their family members, as well as religion and so many other things that comes in of you are looking at this in a practical sense, and there are family members who come in and look and say, look, whatever you do, if that means a machine for 3 months, I want my loved one to keep breathing. And that's really striking.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, there are as many motives and decisions as there are human beings and human systems and families. I mean, the human decision-making engine is very complex. It's, you know, there's so many variables that go into every decision that's made by a patient or a family or their surrogate. And that's why it's so important, for sure, to have thought about this upstream from the ICU, to have really considered your death, to have accepted the fact that you're going to die, and to have thought about it and planned for it, so that when those times come, your desires, your personal preferences can be brought into the care plan. And you're not depending on emotional family members, and, you know, you're not leaving it up to chance. And I think that's the story of all of this. It's possible that, for example, you know, the decisions that were made that may have seemed uncomfortable to watchers were the right decisions, ultimately. No one really knows, because the only person who knows is the person in the bed. And that's why it's so important for that person in the bed to have had conversation after conversation with their loved ones and with their doctors over the years, so that when it comes to that moment that so many of us will experience, people know what to do, and there's no question. And it's about you, and it's not about other people and other things that are going on in the world.
You've been doing this how many years?
Well, I graduated from medical school in 1992. I graduated from my residency in 1995, and I graduated from my fellowship in 2000.
So the reason I ask is because even in watching the film, as you are trying to communicate with the patients, you look at them, and there is, it just seems as used to this as you are, and as commonplace it is, I think in your work, there is still that frustration that you are unable to communicate with the person who is lying in that bed.
It's true. I think part of what propelled me into this interest in communication and made me so passionate about communicating with people and informing and educating people on even on a sort of more of an advocacy level about how important it is for them to communicate, is that as an ICU doctor, I am constantly confronted by the care, or I'm constantly involved in the care of people who I can't talk to, or who it's extremely difficult for me to talk to, and I just can't know what would this person tell me if they could sit and look at me and say, doctor, this is what I want you to do right now. And it's incredibly painful to have that be the first time that a person is ever expressing their feeling, or that someone's trying to imagine what they would say if they were in this particular, you know, if they were able to talk to us.
You write about this in the book, but these life-extending treatments and the technology that we have, I mean, let's face it, we have incredible technology. But when placed in an ICU, what challenge does that present you? What challenge does that present the patient? And what challenge does that present the family? Because what you can do and what you should do are two very different things, as you point out.
Ultimately, what I always try to remember is that it comes down to the patient's preferences. And I'll tell you, I can't know what a person is going to want. And I want to honor what a person wants, even if it's completely different from what I would want for myself. So it all ultimately comes down to conversation, communication, and understanding that person as a unique individual. You know, in the book, I tell the story of two people. Both are patients who absolutely refused treatments that I thought they should have. For one, it was a man with colon cancer who I thought should get a certain type of chemotherapy that I thought would help him, and he absolutely didn't want it. And another, it was a woman who had very serious cancer that had caused major bone breakage in her pelvis, and she was in profound pain. And she wouldn't even let me treat her with pain medications or with bone strengthening treatments that are very low risk. And, you know, ultimately I tried and tried and tried to convince them, and I realized that, you know, sometimes I'm trying to convince someone to do less treatment, sometimes I'm trying to convince someone to do more treatment, but ultimately it's that person's choice. And if that person can't speak to me, then the next person who gets to speak for them is their surrogate. And you hope that that surrogate knows the person and knows what they would say if they were here.
And that isn't always the case. I mean, even what, and I think what's interesting, and you bring this out, and I've seen this where you, the what the person wants may change over time too. Even if they are in a situation where they are conscious and are able to make a decision, that decision may change from what they had told the family earlier.
That's right. And that's why this is such an important process. It's not a one and done. It's a process over a lifetime. People do change. And, you know, you need to revisit these beliefs and thoughts. And you need to, you know, especially as a person develops a disease and that disease starts to advance, things may change. And so this is an active conversation in life that needs to be going, and it's certainly not one that should ever be waited for, and, you know, until moments of extremis. It's something that should be encountered early on in life.
In how do you define extremis?
Extremis, I actually looked it up. It's a term we use a lot in the medical field. In fact, we use it a lot in the intensive care unit. And I think the director of the film got the idea to call it extremis because I say the word extremis so much. But what I mean by extremis, and what I remember the definition in the dictionary is that it's a moment of profound physiologic disturbance before death. So, you know, really suffering and kind of chaos that happens in a person's body before they die. So, you know, a sense of, you can imagine, not the best time to be having conversations about decision making and what a person wants us to do.
I was struck. I'm going to just tell a personal story here in the way of a bridge to getting to a larger point, which is when my we're going on almost a decade ago, my mother had a massive stroke and was in the intensive care unit and the stroke unit, and it was, I would say, maybe 13, 14 days before she passed. There was a point where, you know, you start working with the bureaucracy of the hospital and with the different doctors who are all amazing and incredible. But, you know, they'll answer questions. But it's often really important to know what question to ask. And one of the things that I learned was, you know, we were going on this thing of that my mother was in this state and she was unable to communicate and. We got into whether comfort care was something that we wanted to explore or if, you know, you want to have a feeding tube and all of this. And there was a there was this question as to, okay, what would the next step be? Where would the next facility be? What would you do? And I remember just asking a very, very specific question of, you know, if we do this, in your experience as a doctor, what is the longest you have seen a patient survive? And they said personally 14 days. And I said, okay, well then now I know, because we're not talking about years. We're not talking about months. We're talking about days. Now, and I say this with great respect to the doctor. Now that I believe that is not information that I would have gotten unless I asked that particular question. And I got this sense in reading the book and watching the short film is that you have to know in your position when to inject and when not to, which I think would also be very difficult.
You mean when to bring information to people?
Yes.
And when to not?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, here's the thing. There's something called uncertainty, which we know in lay terms what uncertainty is, but doctors are not really comfortable with uncertainty. We're very scientific, and we feel like we need to really know something before we say it as a possibility. That sounds too mushy. And the problem is, when you think about it, perfect certainty isn't achievable until someone's dead.
Right.
And so if we waited to break bad news until we were really certain that someone was dying, it would often be too late. It would often be, or maybe even after the person had already died. And I am a firm believer, and it's very difficult for me to this day, that we need to be able to tolerate uncertainty, and we still need to be able to communicate in the face of uncertainty. And that's just not something that happens a lot. And so that's why you had to ask that doctor, because doctors don't volunteer information if they're not sure about it. If there's a range, oh, it could be this or it could be that. And I think one of the things that we are learning from the palliative care movement is that there are ways to communicate information that's very important to families without being certain, but to give them, well, you know, in my experience, which is pretty extensive, but in my experience, I could be wrong, but this is my general sense. This is what I'm thinking you should be expecting. And you know what? If she lives longer, if she lives better, let's all party. But this is what I'm thinking. That's really valuable. And we don't do that enough. And, you know, that's why you sometimes need to ask for it. And in my book, I really do try to show you how to ask for that kind of information that can be so helpful.
Even if we plan for it, even if we as a patient think of how we would want to be treated and have those discussions, those ongoing discussions, we still, you know, it happens when it happens, and if you have a moment and you don't expect it to happen on Thursday, but it happens on Thursday and there you are. How much of it is on you, the patient, on you, the family member, and ultimately on you, the doctor, to make that work the way that you know the patient wants it to work, which is a long way of saying that, I mean, you have a different philosophy and you talk about this in the book, which may be different than other doctors and other hospitals. And if you come in prepared and wanting it a certain way, how much control can you have over that situation?
So it's a good question. And it, you know, sort of reminds me the way you're asking it of a woman coming in to have a baby and you know, having a birth plan and wanting it to go as planned, and you hear about people whose birth plan doesn't go as they wanted it to, and who can really live with, you know, regret and frustration for years afterwards. And I think it's the same thing. I mean, I think there's a certain amount of control we have, but you know, much of it is not in our control. we do have control over managing symptoms, and that we can do very, very, very well. But, you know, controlling the exact way and when that someone's going to die and who's going to be at the bedside, and it's not in our control, and I think there's a certain amount of releasing that control that we need to do in order for this to proceed in the most natural and comfortable way. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. But I mean, when I say control, I guess I mean of going in and we have an idea of how we want things to go. But you're also going through a system and you may not be planned for that moment. And I guess, you know, who become your advocates in making sure that of knowing what that patient wants and having that conveyed to the hospital and to the doctors who are there at that moment?
Well, right. I mean, that's really important. The people who are going to be, you know, most responsible ultimately, since, you know, oftentimes the doctors don't know you, is the surrogates, the people in your life, the people that you are closest to, the people who know you the best, the person that you have chosen on your advance directive to represent you as your, you know, your decision maker if you can no longer speak for yourself. So, you know, it's very important that those people really be firmly rooted in who you are and as a person and your preferences and values, and so that they can speak for you in real time and have things happen as closely to the way you would want them to happen as could be expected.
The name of the book is Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. The book is published by Avery. We should also note that you can check out the Netflix documentary Extremis, which is available on Netflix and is really a fascinating short documentary as well. Dr. Jessica Zitter, I thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.